Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. It is Thursday, June 28th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. Today on the Audio Stash, we're going to offer in-depth coverage of this very important new piece of medical research regarding smoked marijuana. It's just out this week. Human clinical trials involving marijuana are unfortunately few and far between. So this newest study from researchers at Columbia University in New York will likely be in the national news spotlight this week. We're very pleased to break this news today right here at your first source for marijuana information, Normal's Daily Audio Stash. First, let's get to the study itself. This news release is written by Normal's senior policy analyst, Paul Armentano. Important breaking news today from Normal in Washington, D.C. Cannabis has clear medical benefits for HIV patients, study says. From New York City, New York. Inhaling cannabis significantly increases daily caloric intake and body weight in HIV-positive patients, is well-tolerated, and does not impair subjects' cognitive performance, according to clinical trial data to be published in the Journal of Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndromes. Investigators at Columbia University in New York assessed the efficacy of inhaled cannabis and oral THC or Marinol in a group of 10 HIV-positive patients in a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial. All of the subjects participating in the study had prior experience using marijuana therapeutically and were taking at least two antiretroviral medications. Researchers reported that smoking cannabis of 2.0 to 3.9% THC four times daily, quote, produced substantial increases in food intake with little evidence of discomfort and no impairment of cognitive performance, close quote. On average, patients who smoked higher grade cannabis or 3.9% THC increased their body weight by 1.1 kilograms over a four-day period. Researchers reported that inhaling cannabis increased the number of times subjects ate during the study, but did not alter the average number of calories consumed during each meal. Investigators said that the administration of oral THC produced similar weight gains in patients, but only at doses that were, quote, eight times current recommendations, close quote. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the prescription use of Marinol, a gelatin capsule containing synthetic THC, in sesame seed oil to treat HIV/AIDS-related cachexia in 1992. Subjects in the study reported feeling intoxicated after either using cannabis or oral THC, but remarked that these effects were, quote, positive and well-tolerated, close quote. Although not a primary outcome measure of the trial, authors reported that patients made far fewer requests for over-the-counter medications while taking either cannabis or oral THC than they did when administered placebo. Most of these requests were to treat patients' gastrointestinal complaints, nausea, diarrhea, and upset stomach, investigators said. Patients in the study also reported that smoking higher-strength marijuana subjectively improved their sleep better than oral THC. Quote, the data demonstrate that over 4 days of administration, smoked marijuana and oral THC produced a similar range of positive effects, increasing food intake and body weight and producing a good drug effect without producing uncomfortable levels of intoxication or impairing cognitive function, close quote, the authors wrote. They added, quote, smoked marijuana has a clear medical benefit in HIV-positive subjects by increasing food intake and improving mood and objective and subjective sleep measures, close quote. A previous preliminary trial by Columbia investigators published in the journal Psychopharmacology in 2005 also reported that inhaling cannabis, quote, produces substantial increases in food intake in HIV-positive patients without producing adverse effects, close quote. Survey data indicates that an estimated 1 out of 3 HIV/AIDS patients in North America use cannabis therapeutically to combat symptoms of the disease and or the side effects of antiretroviral medications. Clinical trial data published in the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2003 reported that cannabis use by HIV patients is associated with increased CD4 T-cell counts compared to non-users. A separate study published in the Journal of Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndromes in 2005 found that HIV/AIDS patients who report using medical marijuana are 3.3 times more likely to adhere to their antiretroviral therapy regimens than non-cannabis users. Most recently, investigators at San Francisco General Hospital and the University of California's Pain Clinical Research Center reported this year in the journal Neurology that inhaling cannabis significantly reduced HIV-associated neuropathy or nerve pain compared to placebo. The Columbia University study is one of the first U.S.-led clinical trials to evaluate the efficacy of smoked cannabis to take place in nearly 2 decades, and it is the first to compare the tolerability and efficacy of smoked marijuana and oral THC in HIV patients. Questions about this study can be answered by Normal's senior policy analyst Paul Armentano. You can contact Paul at paul@normal.org. To cover this topic further today, we're welcoming two of our regular medical experts to the program, Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who is professor of psychology at State University of New York, and Dr. John Morgan, who is professor emeritus of pharmacology at the City University of New York. Let's begin with Dr. Earlywine. Mitch, thanks for joining us here today to cover this important new research. Now, the study took a look at dronabinol, which is synthetic THC in a pill. Many know it as Marinol. The two are one and the same. The study looked at that oral THC along with smoked marijuana with HIV patients, showing this tremendous set of benefits. Now, Mitch, many Americans living with HIV and AIDS are already using medical cannabis. Is that right?
In fact, Dr. Fulton, the last author on this paper, has shown in the past that marijuana in folks who don't have any diseases increases caloric intake, and that was going to be the primary push for this. And yeah, anybody who's been anywhere near a medical marijuana state knows that medical cannabis for HIV-related problems is something that at least we have tons of case studies supporting its efficacy. So,
now, Mitch, tell us about the process of this study.
This was actually a very bold and complicated study. Dr. Fulton has a lab where folks can actually be inpatient for a while. They have to hang out and stay there for a long stretch, and then that way you've got much better control over, you know, what other things people are doing while they're experiencing the effects of these various substances. Tons and tons of, you know, prohibitionists say, oh, we've got Marinol, we don't need smoked marijuana for medical uses. And so often they'll do tests where they compare the two, but if you're smoking marijuana, you know you're smoking marijuana, and you may expect things to be better from that. So in this design, they actually take a pill every day and smoke something every day, and then that way you don't know which thing is your actual source of your THC, so then any expectations you might have about one being better than the other are kind of blown out of the water, and then we don't have that argument about, oh, people think marijuana is better just because they think marijuana is better. It's not that it is.
And they also found that HIV patients who had smoked marijuana were also likely being prescribed doses of Marinol that were far too low to have any real effect on their condition.
It's hard, too, because it's orally administered. It takes such a long time for it to digest and have its actual impact. And so folks who I've talked to say they take a small dose, don't get anything, then they take a markedly larger dose, they don't feel anything for a while, then 3 hours later they're stoned to the bone and they can't really function the way they'd like to.
An interesting aspect of this study showed a very clear difference between Marinol and smoked marijuana when it came to sleep. The data shows that smoked marijuana had a marked positive difference in patients having better sleep patterns.
There was a study by Carlini years ago suggesting that THC and cannabidiol could both help insomniacs. What I like about this one, though, is it pointed out that only the high dose of cannabis, close to 4% THC cannabis, was the one that had the significant impact on sleep. And it kind of lets us know that, hey, the idea that NIDA cannabis is going to do the trick for folks is perhaps faulty. If we had, you know, pharmaceutical-grade cannabis like they have in the Netherlands is 14% THC, people could use markedly less and get the impact they need on really important symptoms like food intake, nausea, and sleep disturbance.
Now, they did use the NIDA, the National Institute on... Now, they did use NIDA, or National Institute of Drug Abuse, supplied marijuana in this study. That's the marijuana grown at the University of Mississippi. Mitch, has NIDA ever offered any higher THC marijuana for research, or have they used sort of the same plant strain and same potency marijuana all these years?
I've heard rumors that you can get an 8% THC cannabis from them, but they won't send it to you pre-rolled, that it's too sticky, allegedly, for their rolling machine. I find that a little hard to believe, but I haven't seen published data on such a thing. This, you know, brings up Lyle Craker's issue, as we've discussed in the past, where if we could, you know, have another source of cannabis and really get a feel for other strains, I think it would be very, very important. If you go to a medical dispensary in California, you'll see they'll have strains that are, you know, particularly focused on each of these individual symptoms, and we just, you know, there's no way we're going to find out what's most efficient and most effective for these kinds of things until we can get those data.
Mitch, there was also a big difference between dronabinol or Marinol and smoked marijuana when it came to the patient's general mood. Early in the paper, the authors report patients complaining of overall mental cloudiness with the Marinol, but not with the smoked marijuana as such.
The beauty of any kind of inhaled vapor is that you pretty much can tell what the impact's going to be within a few seconds. If you've, you know, swallowed a pill and have to wait for it to digest for a few hours, you have no idea how high you're going to go, and that can be disturbing in its own way. I, you know, do always recommend start with a small dose and move up from there, because the opportunity to titrate with the vapor gives you the chance to really, you know, just alleviate symptoms and not have many psychoactive effects at all. So medical users, again, in California, where I was more familiar with them, have said that they can basically use cannabis to alleviate symptoms and not feel any intoxicating effects. And, in fact, in these data, we saw very little cognitive impairment, but, you know, some pleasant ratings of high and mellow and things like that. I, you know, can hardly say, hey, it would be sad for an AIDS patient to experience a little more mellowness and perhaps a little subjective friendliness and fun.
Indeed. And Mitch, I found it very interesting to read in this study exactly how the patients smoked the marijuana for the study. I wonder if you could touch on that.
Well, we've always been concerned about what they call smoking topography. How is it that we can make it so everybody gets a comparable dose, given that everybody smokes a little differently. Experienced users of cannabis are actually very efficient at knowing how big a hit they can take and how long they can hold it. Inexperienced users, often the reason they don't show any effects on the first time they use is because they take too big a hit and cough it all out, or they don't take a big enough hit. And so in this situation, they've really tried to time things so that your inhalation is part of a timed thing where you hear something, you're supposed to take a draw, and as soon as you hear something else, you stop, and then you exhale after a certain duration. And as you can imagine, this is a little artificial and feels a little strange to people, but if you're told, you know, hold smoke for 10 seconds, then certainly we know that everybody's done it pretty much the same manner, and we can hope that the range of THC in the bloodstream then will become.
Also, authors note that neither the smoked marijuana or the Marinol had any effect on the intense regimen of pharmaceutical medication these HIV patients were taking every day as well.
You know, years ago there was a study on basically white blood cells in a petri dish, and if you gave them, you know, literally way too much THC for an individual cell, they did seem to have some impaired immune function. And so then people were jumping up and down saying that this would translate to humans and to human cannabis users, and it's just pleasant to see that, that's not the case at all.
Perhaps one of the most striking results of the study, and this took place in a very short time, is that these HIV patients who would usually be losing weight actually were taking in enough food and calories to put on some pounds here. That alone is a major result.
I think the key on this is it's easy to think, oh, well, it's just a couple of pounds in 16 days and things like that. But any time you're moving in that direction when you're HIV positive, it is astounding. And we have really horrifying data to show that once weight loss gets to a certain point, death is really imminent. So any time you can hold on to a couple of extra pounds and gain a couple, that could really translate into a longer life.
Mitch, I asked a question along this line when we were discussing Donald Abrams' HIV neuropathy study with smoked marijuana, but do you think that this data, along with Abrams and other research, could allow HIV and AIDS patients, no matter what state they live in, to perhaps gain some federal approval to use medical marijuana, again, even if they don't live in a state that allows medical marijuana access?
I can only hope, Chris. I think these data will particularly help dispute the argument that we've got dronabinol and that's fine, because clearly dronabinol is not having the impact anywhere near as dramatically as the inhaled cannabis. I liked reading this article in part because I've read articles by Dr. Fulton's crew from the early 90s that were markedly less political, and I've been intrigued by this change in attitude and presentation over the years of the stuff that's coming out of this lab, as if they're finally saying, hey, everybody pay attention to us, this is very serious now, and we've tried being objective and nice and scientific in our language, and now we need to jump up and down and say, let's get this medicine available because people are dying.
Mitch, the authors did mention the political atmosphere for medical marijuana a few times in the paper. It's definitely rare for that type of language to enter into a medical research paper. You know, how did you feel about that when you were reading it?
In truth, I always thought the letter of the research is the way to go, and just present the data and let everybody interpret from there. But that hasn't been doing the trick. And now I'm finding more and more cannabis researchers in their discussion sections in particular say, now the implications for this are we need to help the sickest of the sick, so let's go do it. And at first I was worried about that, but now I'm kind of delighted because it's clear that there's no other way to get this to have the effect we want it to have. If you want to wake up and do research that's going to matter, that's a great way to spend your life. But then when people keep ignoring it, no matter what you publish, you have to up the ante, if you will, and point out that the attitudes need to change. And I was happy to see them stick to the data, but then elaborate on these implications, because clearly we're not getting the reaction to this kind of research that we want to see.
Mitch, at the top of the interview, we discussed how common it already is for those living with HIV and AIDS to use medical marijuana. Is there some hope that with all this recent research that patients might feel at least more comfortable discussing marijuana and their marijuana use with their doctors and nurses? I know many of them are just afraid to mention it.
You know, 14 million Americans used marijuana last month. I mean, we all need to come out and go ahead and do this. And it's funny, I was at the doctor recently and had one of those little forms to fill out, and they ask what drugs you use, and I wrote down cannabis because I feel like we all have to kind of come out in this way, and then suddenly things will get normalized a lot more. And particularly for the sickest of the sick, nobody should be surprised if somebody with cancer-related, you know, chemotherapy experiences or HIV is using cannabis. And the idea that we don't talk about it is kind of a shame. I've taken steps in Los Angeles, and I'm trying to take some steps here in Albany to say, let's make sure our physicians are trained on this as well. And so sending articles like this around to people to let them know that this is a really an important treatment, and it's not going to interfere with the other treatments for this disorder is a really great step.
And Mitch, I have to ask here, is there real confidentiality when it comes to this issue in health professionals, especially when it comes to doctors and nurses working with HIV and AIDS patients, that if they mention that they use marijuana, will that be kept in confidence?
The HIPAA forms that you'll also sign will suggest that it's extremely unlikely that your medical forms would be accessible to other folks. And again, you know, I'm pretty out as cannabis users go, but I think as more and more people do it, it'll become more and more normalized, and then suddenly the stigma will disappear. But somebody has to take the first step, and so, of course, a whole bunch of us have, and, you know, we'll pay the price. I figure, you know, if I'm not getting people knocking down my door, perhaps it's okay for other folks to do the same.
Oh, Mitch, I really appreciate you taking time to join us here today to discuss this very important new research. Thank you again for taking time today.
Oh, always a pleasure, Chris.
Thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of the book, Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. We have links to it on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Stay tuned. We're continuing our coverage of this important new study showing that smoked marijuana and oral THC have tremendous positive benefits for HIV patients. Also joining us today to weigh in on this new research is Normal Senior Policy Analyst Paul Armentano. Paul, welcome back to the program today.
Good to be here, Chris.
Great to speak with you today, Paul. We spoke with Mitch Earlywine, and we'll speak with Dr. Morgan here in a moment. Paul, what did you see as the most important aspects of this new research into smoked marijuana?
Well, there's really a couple points I think people need to understand when talking about this study. The first, and arguably most importantly, is that this study shows that HIV patients achieve similar therapeutic relief smoking, you know, quite honestly, average-strength pot, as they do consuming 8 times the recommended dose of the FDA-approved pharmaceutical equivalent, in this case, Marinol. So the reality is we have an FDA-approved drug out there, synthetic THC, a.k.a. Marinol, that is approved for this condition. And this study found that patients get better relief smoking marijuana than they do taking Marinol, and in fact that they only get equivalent relief using Marinol when they take 8 times the recommended dosage. That's a powerful statement.
Now, this paper does fly in the face of much of the political rhetoric we've seen out on medical marijuana lately, especially from governors. Politicians have been saying that they don't want to support medical marijuana access because prescriptions for Marinol are available, but politicians won't be able to use that argument anymore based on this paper showing marijuana to be far more effective than Marinol.
Right. Well, this is the first time a comparison study looking at the efficacy of smoked marijuana versus oral THC has ever been performed in the HIV patient population. And in fact, there's a long backstory to this because researchers starting in the early 1990s had actually proposed comparison studies of this type to FDA and to NIDA, and unfortunately those studies at that time were rejected. That's why I was very pleased to see that apparently some government officials have had a change of heart having allowed this study to move forward currently.
Now, patients were also requesting far fewer over-the-counter medications during this trial when they were getting THC into their system. What does that say here?
Well, interestingly, yes. When patients used either oral THC or inhaled cannabis, researchers reported that they made far fewer requests for over-the-counter or rescue medications than they did when they were on placebo. This actually reaffirms what we've seen in survey data and anecdotally quite a bit, that patients, not just with HIV, but with a number of diseases, generally when those patients are using cannabis therapeutically, their use of other pharmaceutical medications goes way down. And this study bore that out.
And Paul, could those patients living with HIV and AIDS take this research and that of Dr. Abrams directly to their medical professionals and healthcare providers and say they would like to use cannabis therapeutically and right here in their hand, right here is why?
Well, you know, HIV patients with AIDS are actually already using marijuana therapeutically, and they've been doing so now for several decades. In fact, even the researchers in this study note, and there is there are several survey studies that also bear this out, nearly one out of every three patients living with AIDS in North America self-reports having used cannabis therapeutically. So their doctors are aware that they're doing this, and the patient community has been aware that marijuana has medical benefits to treat both the disease and also the side effects of the antiretroviral drugs that they're on. They've known this for some time, and the science now is just beginning to bear this out. Unfortunately, the science would have told us these things much earlier had the government not played politics with the science and had simply allowed this research to take place years earlier when scientists were, many who work closely with this community, were first beginning to propose these kinds of studies be done.
And do you think we'll see more science in this area on cannabis, or is it just too difficult for most researchers to get it done?
No, I actually hope that this will trigger more science, particularly from scientists who work with this particular community. This research team from Columbia actually did a pilot study that was similar, and then they had some results published 2 or 3 years ago. So they've actually been focused on this particular issue now for a number of years, and I would imagine with these sort of findings, they're going to continue to move that research forward.
Paul, we spoke with Donald Abrams about his research with smoked marijuana and HIV neuropathy. Is this new paper and Abrams' research the only research done in this area with this specific patient population?
Actually, Chris, I'm pleased to say over the past few years, there has been a growing body of scientific data affirming what anecdotally the HIV/AIDS community has been telling us. You are correct. Donald Abrams actually has published a pair of studies in recent years looking at the therapeutic use of cannabis in this population. A few years ago, he published a very important trial that found that individuals who use cannabis in no way undermined the effect of their antiretroviral medications, and in fact, they found that patients who use cannabis had actual higher CD4 T cell counts than patients that did not use cannabis. A study out of Australia published earlier this year also reaffirmed that same finding. There's also a very important study that was published in 2005 that found that patients who used cannabis were more than three times likely to stick with their AIDS pharmaceutical regimen than patients who did not use cannabis, and that's likely because marijuana helps them offset many of the adverse side effects of those drugs. And of course, as many of the listeners know, earlier this year, Donald Abrams published a paper showing that inhaling cannabis greatly reduced AIDS-related neuropathy, which is a painful nerve disease that's associated with this condition that opioids generally treat very poorly. So, in fact, the data is now reaffirming what this community has told us.
Paul, let me ask you as well here, do you think that all of the science with cannabis and HIV patients, that all this science could lead to some federal approval for these patients to use medical marijuana at some point?
I think it'll be a long time coming because of the regulatory hurdles marijuana would have to basically jump through, and because of the political climate in Washington. That is not to say, though, that I do not believe the science at this point is fairly clear that inhaled cannabis is safe and effective for treating symptoms of HIV and AIDS.
Well, Paul, thank you again for joining us here today to weigh in during our coverage here. I look forward to speaking with you again about this next week.
No problem, Chris.
And finally, joining us today to discuss the research is Professor Emeritus of Pharmacology at City University of New York and co-author with Lynn Zimmer of the best-selling book Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts, Dr. John P. Morgan. John, thank you for taking time to weigh in on this with us today. You know, why is it so difficult for researchers to conduct clinical trials with smoked marijuana? I mean, this is one of the very few that's been conducted in the last 20 years here in the U.S.
Politics. When you get a copy of the paper, you will notice that reference 22 says, I have it in front of me here, Abraham, short-term effects of cannabinoids in patients with HIV-1 infection. Now, he got that study done in 2003. He'd been proposing to do it for, I think, somewhere around 15 to 20 years. That is, somebody give him some standardized marijuana so he could check it and its outcome in his HIV-positive patients who were using it to increase their appetite, to feel better, to treat the nausea and vomiting, particularly from the antiretrovirals. Now, Abrams, who tried his best, boy, what persistence he had, to get the government to give him the marijuana so he could do this study. It's marvelous that the study is done. It's not marvelous that it's 20 years behind the time it should have been done.
And, John, what did you think of the potency of the marijuana they used here? 3.9% was the highest potency available from the National Institute of Drug Abuse for the study.
Well, of course, people have been talking about the new highly potent THC since 1974. That's the first time Lynn Zimmer and I ever saw it mentioned by a government employee saying, oh, today's marijuana is much more potent. The reality is that today's marijuana is probably a little bit more potent. There are not 20 to 40 times the readings. Now, this material was either 2% or 3.9%. My guess is it's a hell of a lot like what's on the street. It's a possibility it's a little bit on the low side.
And, John, because the higher potency THC marijuana was much more effective here, does that help turn the current federal reefer madness rhetoric of high THC potency being bad on its head? I mean, doesn't this show that the higher the THC content, the better marijuana is for you?
Higher THC marijuana is unquestionably better for you, particularly in this situation in which you are trying to get a drug into you for therapeutic purposes. And unfortunately, administration of this drug to get effective levels has to be accomplished by inhaling cigarette smoke, this time marijuana smoke. So let's say you're a marijuana smoker and you're trying to get in some marijuana and you have fairly potent marijuana. It has been well documented that individuals given higher potency marijuana inhale less, they take fewer puffs, they get less of a smoke toxic load than the THC. So there is no question that in this particular instance, trying to get some marijuana into you to treat your nausea, to give you some appetite, et cetera, it's better to have high potency marijuana. In fact, I look forward to this study being done with 5 or 7 or even 10% marijuana.
Let me ask you this as well, John. Do you think that, you know, HIV and AIDS patients could get some sort of federal approval for medical marijuana soon because of all this research, this new paper included?
It's not going to take much more. We're getting closer and closer. Now, I don't want to be in the foolish position of saying it's just a few years away, which is what some of my dear friends said in 1970. So we still face bad politics. We still face prejudice. We still face people that think that providing medical marijuana is a sin and a bad thing to do. But just as you said, we've got more and more data. We have more and more people. I think the data, patients in treatment in U.S. and Canadian programs are already one-third of them smoking marijuana anyway, wherever they can get it. This study indicates that they're smoking it for very good reasons. It helps them. It helps them sleep. It helps their appetite. It helps their nausea. So I am quite optimistic in this study, particularly coming from a very official conservative place like the Columbia Research Institute and the Department of Psychiatry at the College of Physicians and Surgeons at Columbia, that coming from this kind of institute, we're getting closer.
Dr. Morgan, you know, you follow all of the marijuana research quite closely out there. Does this group who authored this study today, do they have a history of marijuana research?
Yes, they do. They have a unit at the hospital at 178th Street in Manhattan, which is the hospital of the College of Physicians and Surgeons for Columbia, and they actually have an inpatient unit. And over the years, they have done such studies as to show that if you give people marijuana, they eat more candy bars ad libitum, and they've done a number of such studies in which they can actually have people volunteer to come and live in the center. They have a suite with bathrooms and dining rooms, and people can be observed, and people can be observed carefully, given studies, watched carefully, have their sleep assessed. So they have a very, very nice unit in which they are trying to learn more and more. I think they got off to a slow start. I'm not entirely sure why, but right now we are learning a lot from these people at Columbia.
And Dr. Morgan, what do you hope people will take away from reading this new data?
Well, I hope everybody in the world gets to hear this. I point out that these people who were taking a higher dose of marijuana, although they got high, they had, quote, intoxication, they were not dysfunctional. They were cognitively secure. They passed all the tests. They did fine. It is my opinion that at this dose of inhaled marijuana, they are not likely to experience pulmonary toxicity, just as most people who are low-dose marijuana smokers don't experience pulmonary toxicity. They won't get cancer, and they won't get COPD, even if they take it for a number of years. So I am, this study raises my hopes, makes me feel really good.
That was Dr. John P. Morgan. He is Professor Emeritus of Pharmacology at State University of New York and co-author of the book, Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts. We have links to all of the books we talked about, to our three expert panelists here today, up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's NORMALAUDIOSTASH.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.